From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The international solidarity movement is facing unprecedented roundup and arrest by the Israeli military forces. This only can indicate that Israel is trying to prevent the rest of the world from seeing its human rights abuses in the occupied territories.
Today, we'll take a look at Israeli policy in the occupied territories, and then we'll hear a speech from the late Episcopal Bishop of New York. He was buried this weekend, Paul Moore.
The only way we can become peaceful in this world is to get at the roots of the anger. The roots of the anger against America is that in many parts of the world, for millions of people, we are the terrorists.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a major overhaul of leadership in Iraq, most of Washington's top civil administrators in Baghdad are being sent home. Retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner is expected to leave within the next 2 weeks. Barbara Boudin, who has been in charge of reconstruction for the Baghdad region, will be leaving within the next day or two. Others expected to leave soon include Margaret Tutwiler, who was in charge of overall communications, Tim Carney, who's been overseeing Iraq's Ministry of Industry and Minerals, David Dunfer, a senior foreign service specialist on the Middle East, and John Limbert, the ambassador to Mauritania. This all comes as State Department veteran Paul Bremer arrived in Basra today to become the new top administrator in charge of rebuilding Iraq. He was formerly with Kissinger Associates. The BBC reports that Iraqis have become increasingly frustrated that their lives remain in chaos more than a month after Saddam Hussein's regime was toppled. Several Baghdad neighborhoods still lack electricity and running water. Rubbish is piled up in the streets, and many shopkeepers are reportedly too afraid of looters to reopen their businesses. There is a lack of security, ministries are not working properly, and salaries are not being paid. We're going to turn now to Sharif Abdel Quddus, Democracy Now! Producer, who is in Baghdad. Just before the program, we received this short report.
The situation in Baghdad over the last few days seems to have grown more and more tense. The looting and violence continues. There are buildings on fire around the city, and at night you can hear the crackle of gunfire intermittently. Carjackings are very common. The day before yesterday, one of my colleagues was in a car about a few hundred meters down the street from the Sheraton Hotel, where we are staying. He watched as five men, two of them armed with pistols, swarmed around the car and directly in front of him. He saw one man point his gun inside the driver's seat window and fire six shots at the driver. This was at about 2:30 p.m. and happened only a couple of streets down from where a U.S. Army tank and a few soldiers were stationed. So it seems not safe in the city. Also yesterday, the telephone exchange building on Rashid Street was on fire. This was at about 1 in the afternoon. I rushed over there after seeing...
And at that moment, as we were receiving the report from Sharif, his report cut off. We are going to turn back to the news headlines now and see if we can get him on the line. Sharif Abdel Quddus reporting from Baghdad. A new report by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization says Iraq's agricultural system is on the brink of collapse, raising fears that many of Iraq's 24 million people will go hungry this summer. According to the London Observer, government warehouses that would have served as the main suppliers of seeds, fertilizers and pesticide sprays have been looted, particularly in the center and south of the country. The group directing all known U.S. search efforts for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is winding down operations and is planning to head home after finding no proof that President Saddam Hussein kept clandestine stocks of outlawed arms. This according to a report in The Washington Post. Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, the most prominent leader among Iraq's majority Shia Muslims, has crossed into Iraq for the first time after 23 years of exile. He told an ecstatic rally of up to 100,000 supporters in Basra that Iraq must have a totally independent government. Doctors in Iraq fear that hundreds of Iraqis may be suffering from radiation poisoning following the widespread looting of the country's nuclear facilities, this according to the London Telegraph. Many residents in villages close to the huge Tawatha nuclear facility, about 7 miles south of Baghdad, were showing signs of radiation illness last week, including rashes, acute vomiting, and severe nosebleeds. Alarmed by the reports, the International Atomic Energy Agency last week sent a letter to reiterate earlier demands that the U.S. grant the agency access to Iraq's nuclear sites, but so far there has been no response. The Bush administration took a step toward developing a new generation of nuclear weapons Friday when the Senate Armed Services Committee approved a bill that would lift a 10-year ban on researching small atomic bombs. The bill also provides $15.5 million in funding for research on a large hydrogen bunker buster bomb called the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator, a bomb which would be at least 6 times more powerful than the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. Secretary of State Colin Powell said Israel must ease restrictions and hardships on Palestinians in the occupied territories. The comments were made during a joint news conference with Palestine's new prime minister, Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen. Powell is in the Middle East to promote support for the U.S.-backed plan for Middle East peace, but Powell left Israel today without gaining any firm commitment from Israel to the plan. Meanwhile, the Israeli army reimposed a full closure of the Gaza Strip late yesterday because of, quote, security considerations, less than 24 hours after lifting restrictions to coincide with Powell's visit. On Friday, Israeli troops raided the offices of the International Solidarity Movement. Two international activists were arrested and will be deported. We'll have more on that story in a few minutes. This news just in from Chechnya. At least 30 people were killed today, dozens more injured after a trailer loaded with explosives rammed into a government building. The BBC reports the attack in the northern town of Znamenskoye is being blamed on Chechen rebels who are fighting for independence from Moscow. International monitors have left Indonesia's western province of Aceh ahead of a possible military attack against rebels. The Indonesian government has demanded the Free Aceh movement abandon their independence campaign, lay down their arms, and start talks on local autonomy. 600 more Indonesian troops are expected to arrive in Aceh shortly to join thousands of soldiers already in the province. The Indonesian military has killed thousands in Aceh over the last years. Michael Powell, chair of the Federal Communications Commission, is expected to propose an increase in the U.S. television cap from 35% to 45% when he presents a draft of new media ownership rules to his fellow commissioners today. This, according to the Financial Times, the existing cap prevents one company from reaching more than 35% of the U.S. national television audience. Increasing the cap would allow large television networks to buy more local stations. It would also eliminate the need for Viacom, which owns CBS and Fox, to divest stations because they currently are in breach of the cap. On June 2nd, the FCC's 5 commissioners will vote on Powell's proposals. This news from London. Clare Short resigned this morning from Tony Blair's cabinet. The International Development Secretary accused Blair of breaching assurances he made to her about the need for a legitimate Iraqi government organized under a UN mandate. And FBI investigators now suspect that the anthrax-filled letters sent to politicians and media figures in 2001 may have been prepared underwater using equipment investigators have discovered in a Maryland pond. This according to the Washington Post. The find represents the first physical evidence to surface in a case, and it strengthens the growing belief that the attacks were carried out by someone with possible links with the U.S. biodefense establishment. The pond on the outskirts of Washington is 8 miles from Fort Detrick, the headquarters of the Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. No suspects have been named so far in the investigation, but the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, has named Stephen Hatfill as a, quote, person of interest in the inquiry. The Washington Post noted that Hatfill is a former Fort Detrick employee and bioterrorism. He also had a postgraduate diploma in diving and underwater medicine from a South African Naval Training Institute. In fact, he trained in South Africa under apartheid. Hatfill has vigorously denied any involvement and has accused the FBI of ruining his life by leaking its suspicions to the press. We gotta have peace to keep the world alive and war to cease. We gotta have joy, true in our hearts with strength we can't destroy. People hear us through our voice, the world knows there's no choice. But they can save. We got to have peace. Curtis Mayfield here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers. And Amy, on this 12th of May, 2003, we're finding out that the Bush administration is more capable of unleashing war in Iraq than of fashioning some kind of a peace, because the chaos and the anarchy continue throughout all of Iraq. It turns out that the French and the Germans were right. They kept warning that the Bush administration was unleashing forces that they had no idea what would be the results.
And on the domestic level, we're talking about the FCC further laying out what it is they're going to allow, something you, Juan, as president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, has been following very closely.
Well, it's interesting. Last Friday on the show, I mentioned that Michael Powell had yet to reveal what his plans were to his own commissioners. And apparently, over the weekend now, he's decided to do that. And you had the report there from the Financial Times that today he will let them know finally, because even his own commissioners were complaining that he wasn't revealing what his plans were on all the rules changes. But this is only one rule, the 35% rule, which is really the Murdoch rule. Because Fox and Viacom, as you mentioned, are the ones most interested. But there's still the issue of television and broadcast cross ownership. Will a newspaper be allowed to own a television station in the same city? The issue of duopolies in television. Can a television company own more than two television stations in the same city? The radio limits. There's a whole bunch of other rules that we still have to see what Powell will do on them.
Juan, it looks like Sharif Abdelkaddous is on the line. We heard a very quick report of him from him in news headlines. He is our Democracy Now! Producer right now in Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sharif. Sharif, are you able to hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Can you just continue with the report that you began during our news headlines, and hopefully we'll get you as long as we can until your phone cuts off?
Okay, I was describing a carjacking incident which happened near our hotel. I'm not sure how much of you played of it. It seems just no one in Baghdad is safe. You know, someone basically shot a driver of a car right next to the hotel, right next to a couple of tanks, U.S. Army tanks which were stationed there. There's also a lot of buildings on fire around the city. I saw yesterday the telephone exchange building on Rashid Street was on fire. I rushed over there to find a crowd of Iraqis underneath the building, pointing and shouting. I looked up and saw a person on the sixth floor looking out of the window. They were trapped inside. There was thick black smoke pouring out of every floor of the building, and a rescue attempt didn't seem plausible. The U.S. tank and a few Humvees arrived about 45 minutes after the fire started. The Iraqis, you know, wanted to go up and kind of help save the person. Obviously, the soldiers are refused. I heard one Iraqi shout in Arabic, "We are finally rid of Saddam, and now we have to deal with this," presumably referring to the U.S. occupation. It seems like Baghdad is on fire. Every time I look out the window, I see different buildings on fire. The main duty-free shop was burning yesterday, as well as another couple of buildings, one of which I think was the main TV center. But the situation in the capital is this. The looting, the violence, the burglary can come anytime, anywhere, from anyone. There's no sense of security or order whatsoever. Many people have asked me what drives the people to commit such acts. You know, I'm not sure. But imagine what it would be like if New York City, for example, all of a sudden there was no police in the city. It would be a free-for-all. And I imagine the situation would be very much the same as it is here, if not worse. But generally, from the Iraqis I've spoken to, there's a conflict between relief at being free of Saddam's brutal regime and bitterness and despair at the current lawlessness and disorder in the country. That's the impression I've got from most Iraqis. Another thing that I've noticed around the city is the gas situation. It seems to be getting much worse. The lines for petrol stations now extend about a kilometer or more in some places, with two or three cars abreast. Some people get in line at about 4 a.m. in the morning, you know, to get a good spot in line and a chance of reaching the pump before it runs out. And, you know, watching U.S. Army vehicles drive past these gas lines, you're struck by the incredible irony of, you know, inhabitants of the second most oil-rich country in the Middle East scrambling for gas as their foreign invaders cruise past them on full tanks. There seems to be also increasing signs of resistance to the occupation in the city. I see slogans written on walls throughout Baghdad proclaiming things like, "You'll be dead, U.S. Army," or "Muslims be united." And right near a hotel, there was another one written, "U.S. Army, go back." And the situation carries on, it has been, without any law or order. I feel the repercussions later on. I spoke with...
Sharif, are you still there? Well, looks like we lost him.
Be completed successfully.
Ah, there we go. But we got more report from him than we did before. It is very difficult to make communication with people in Baghdad still. That is Sharif Abdelkaddous, producer of Democracy Now! In Baghdad. And we thank him for that report. As we turn now to Israel and the occupied territories. On Friday, the Israeli military raided the offices of the International Solidarity Movement in the West Bank. More than 20 Israeli army jeeps surrounded the ISM offices before soldiers broke into the building. They confiscated computers and documents and arrested three people. Two international activists are expected to be deported. They're 28-year-old Christine Rosowski of Chicago and Australian Miranda Sessions, who worked for the New York-based Human Rights Watch. 22-year-old Palestinian Fida Gharib was also arrested. The raid came just hours after the Israeli military announced it would begin requiring foreigners entering the Gaza Strip to sign waivers absolving the Israeli army from any responsibility if the army shoots them. Visitors must also declare that they are not peace activists and not connected to the international solidarity movement. Foreigners are also being forbidden from approaching security walls near Jewish settlements and from entering parts of Rafah, which the Israeli army considers to be a military zone. In recent months, several members of the international solidarity movement have been killed or seriously wounded during Israeli incursions into the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In March, an Israeli bulldozer crushed Rachel Corrie, a 23-year-old from Olympia, Washington, when she tried to prevent it from demolishing Palestinian homes. Last month, the Israeli army shot an unarmed British peace activist from the group in the head. 21-year-old Tom Herndl remains in critical condition. And on April 5th, Israeli forces shot 24-year-old Brian Avery in the face. He, too, remains in critical condition. The British government has also demanded an investigation into the shooting death of British cameraman James Miller, who was killed last week while shooting a documentary for HBO in the Gaza refugee camp of Rafah. We turn right now to Adam Shapiro. Adam is the founder of the International Solidarity Movement. Adam, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you start off by responding to the Israeli military's announcements and raids?
Well, the ISM has sort of expected the repercussions by the army. On April 16th, the chief of staff of the Israeli military, General Ya'alon, said that they would start uprooting the ISM. Now, it's almost ironic in that the reason that they're giving for removing the ISM is that we block the military's freedom of ability to move. Certainly, this is what we do because the military is operating in civilian areas, in Palestinian civilian areas. The refugee camp where Rachel was killed, where the BBC correspondent James Miller was killed, where Tom Herndl was shot in the head. This is a civilian area. This is where regular people live. This is where they have their homes. And in fact, this is where people who have suffered tremendously in their lives, the refugees, live. So we feel it's important for us to be there to get in the way of the military in order to prevent more civilian deaths. Over 2,000 Palestinians have been killed. Over 80% of them, in reports by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, have been civilians. So we feel it's important for us to be there.
And why do you think that the ISM has been in the occupied territories now for quite some time in the process of the Intifada developing? Why now do they seem now more zeroing in on ISM members?
I don't think it's because of anything that the ISM has done. I think it's because of what the Israeli army has done. They have now killed an American citizen. They have now severely injured another American citizen and a British citizen. And I think the undue attention that Israel has drawn to itself by its very actions is the reason that Israel is now trying to absolve itself of any kind of responsibility, as we saw with this new diktat for Gaza.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. Then we're going to go to Nablus, to an international solidarity movement volunteer there. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
So we can do just just a living people. We won't have a thing. So we've got nothing to lose. We could all be free. Maybe not with words, maybe not with a look, but with your mind. You've got to choose a wish or command. At the turn of the tide is weathering thee. Remember one thing, a dream you can see. Pray it to be. Shake this land. We all do what we can.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, maybe not Cat Power here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we look at what's happening now in the occupied territories and in Israel, General Powell just there over the weekend, the Secretary of State. In our studio, we are joined by Adam Shapiro, co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement. Again, the latest news, Israeli military raiding the offices of the International Solidarity Movement in the West Bank. More than 20 Israeli army jeeps surrounding the ISM offices before soldiers broke into the building. Two international activists expected to be deported. The raid coming just hours after the Israeli military announced it'll begin requiring foreigners entering the Gaza Strip to sign waivers absolving the Israeli army from any responsibility if the army shoots them. Also today, news of an Israeli who was killed in the Gaza Strip. Any word of that, Adam Shapiro?
Unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to receive word about this. No.
We're also joined from Nablus by Hussein Khalili, who is ISM coordinator in the West Bank town of Nablus. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Hussein.
Hi. Hi, Adam. Hi, everybody.
Can you tell us what is happening there and what the ISM's response in the West Bank is to the latest Israeli military edict there?
Actually, the ISM is a nonviolent movement, and we are working against the violence. The new Israeli policy, actually, they don't want witnesses and there's a crime here. We are working here as, you know, observers. We try to work against violence, and we try to find a way to have, you know, negotiating between the people and try to build the trust between the Palestinians and the Israelis. We are working with these activists. More than 20% of the volunteers in the ISM and the founder, one of the founders, Jewish. So we are talking about a movement, try to have a new kind of relation with, between the Israelis and the Palestinians. We try to make the violence less. We try to have another kind of struggle against occupation. The occupation is illegal. So the nonviolence, it's our, you know, philosophy here. But the Israelis' policy now, they don't want any witnesses. They shot journalists and ISMers. I think they try to, they don't want to have any people here to witness their crimes. Anyway, we are here, we will continue our work in West Bank and Gaza. We will not stop.
And Hussein, what kind of day-to-day pressure are the ISM members under? Are you constantly under surveillance by the Israeli military, or are they a constant presence around your offices?
Excuse me, I didn't.
I said, what kind of day-to-day pressure are you under? Are the ISM members on the West Bank under from the Israelis?
Actually, you know about what happened in Deir Sahor, and the day before yesterday. They arrested three of our ISMers in the Tulkarem area. Osama Khashoggi is coordinator of ISM in Tulkarem. They arrested him from the street. And then they arrested Radhika, she's an American citizen, and Charlotte, she's Irish. They arrested them Osama had beat him from soldiers and spent a night in the hospital. They released Charlotte and Radhika yesterday, but they are waiting for their trial. It's kind of pressure that we are now really at risk to try to pass the checkpoints in West Bank or Gaza. We are at risk to be in the houses that we are trying to prevent soldiers to demolish those houses. They really make our work really difficult, but what can I say that we should continue.
Adam Shapiro, would you like to add a comment to that? And also, we are looking at what's happened to the internationals there. James Miller, who is well known for the documentary he did on Afghanistan, Beneath the Veil, who's worked for the BBC, for CNN, just came out of Iraq, headed to look at the effect of violence on Palestinian children, documentary for HBO, just shot in the neck. An investigation was done, and at first the Israeli military said, well, it could have been a Palestinian sniper, but now they are seeing that the bullet that went into his neck, in fact, it does look like it was from the Israeli military.
Well, just on the first point about the ISM, we have had a number of activists arrested recently, though a number of them have been released from Israeli detention in Israel with orders that they are not to return to, and the wording is quite deliberate here, Samaria. It's the Hebrew Israeli word for the West Bank, for the northern West Bank. And so it shows absolutely no acknowledgement by Israel that is occupying this territory, that it recognizes that this is Palestinian territory. And so we, our activists will be, you know, they will not be abiding by these orders. As for the targeting of internationals, and this goes for journalists as well, and there have been many journalists killed, both international and Palestinian journalists killed during this intifada by the Israeli military. In James Miller's case, at first, the very first report by the Israelis was that they did acknowledge that they shot James Miller. And it was only after the outcry and the attention that this received that they started to change the story, that it might have been a Palestinian gunman, even though all eyewitness accounts were to the contrary, that there was no firing from the Palestinian side. Now, an autopsy, I think, has been done, and it seems that, indeed, the bullet was from an Israeli sniper.
And is your sense that, in essence, that the escalated Israeli repression against the ISM is really a reflection of the increasing impact that your volunteers are having on the international reflection and view of what's going on in the occupied territories?
I think in part. I think because we have international civilians coming back, normal people from all walks of life, not just, and tragically, younger people have been targeted by the army and have been injured and killed, but we have activists ranging in age up to 88 years old who join us in the occupied territories. And I do think it's their voices that are getting out, that are reaching to Americans and British civilians and French and Italian and whoever, and letting them know what's really happening on the ground that's making an impact. Additionally, I do think it's because Israel has targeted these people, and by its own very own actions by soldiers, has drawn the attention to itself and now just wishes to get rid of the problem entirely.
Adam Shapiro, you spent a good amount of time in the West Bank. You're back here in school now in Washington, D.C., in graduate school. You got a lot of attention when you got into the compound that the Israeli military had surrounded and was destroying of Yasser Arafat and met with him. You are a Jewish New Yorker, part of the International Solidarity Movement, who married the Palestinian founder of the International Solidarity Movement. As you now return here, what kind of perspective do you get here, or information or lack of information are you getting here that was different from when you were living in the West Bank?
There's absolutely no reporting going on, with the exception of this show and a few others, of Palestinian life, of what is actually transpiring day to day in the occupied Palestinian territories. If we contrast that to what's happening in Iraq, we do get reports, albeit not great reports, and certainly not with any sort of depth from the mainstream media about what's happening on the ground in Baghdad, at least in Baghdad. Other cities are being totally ignored. But we at least have a sense of what the events that are transpiring in Baghdad, in Iraq, of what occupation is, what the chaos is, how people have to live their lives. We hear about checkpoints in Iraq. We don't hear about checkpoints in the in Palestinian territories. We don't hear about the home demolitions on a daily basis. We don't hear about the massive roundups on a daily basis. The difference, one major difference, and this is shows the importance of having the ISM there, is that in Baghdad, journalists basically have more or less free access all around. The while the occupation forces in Iraq certainly would wish journalists not to end up reporting on what they are reporting, in the Palestinian territories, Israel is able to completely bar journalists from reporting from inside the occupied territories. They bar their own journalists from reporting there. Only one Israeli journalist reports from inside the occupied territories who lives there, Amira Haas, and Gidol Nevi, another journalist, makes occasional trips into the occupied territories to follow stories. Aside from that, any photos, any video has to go through an IDF censorship office, and so Israeli citizens don't know what's happening inside the occupied territories.
Well, Adam Shapiro, we want to thank you very much for being with us. One of the founders of the International Solidarity Movement in our Firehouse studio. As we turn now to a man who fought for social, racial, economic justice in this country and around the world his entire life of 83 years, he was Bishop Paul Moore, the retired Episcopal Bishop of New York. He died at his home in Greenwich Village on May 1st. In recent months, he was suffering from brain cancer and lung cancer. Bishop Moore spoke out against corporate greed, racism, military spending, and for more assistance to the nation's poor. He was an early advocate of women's ordination, and in 1977 was the first Episcopal bishop to ordain a lesbian as an Episcopalian priest. Moore was born to a wealthy family in Morristown, New York, graduated from Yale, served as a Marine captain during World War II, wounded in the Battle of Guadalcanal, and received the Navy Cross, the Silver Star, and the Purple Heart. During his tenure as the Episcopal bishop, Bishop Moore transformed the seat of the diocese, the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, from a moribund backwater church to a place where peacocks roamed, elephants lumbered, orchestras performed, inner-city youth found jobs, and the homeless slept in supervised shelters. He opened the cathedral for rallies against racism and on behalf of nuclear disarmament. When criticized that he was using the church for political purposes, Bishop Moore said religion and progressive social policies were inexorably linked. He took on the cause of the East Timorese and traveled there several times during the Indonesian occupation of Timor. This Saturday, I went to St. John the Divine, where a mass funeral was held for the former bishop. Thousands of people turned out. Today we thought we'd play a speech that Bishop Moore gave last Christmas along with other religious people against an invasion of Iraq. This is what Bishop Moore had to say.
In 1942, I was a Marine lieutenant leading a rifle platoon in the attack of the Marines on Guadalcanal. I was there for 3 months and then I was shot through here. I had 38 kids with me, and by the time we were through, there were only 7 that were left. The other had been wounded or had been killed. And I held some of them in my arms. I saw the blood. I saw beautiful American kids killed, Japanese soldiers killed, and we'd open their tunic, and there would be a picture of them in their kimono with their children and their wife. And we had killed them like shooting rabbits. I remember that. And that really is the reason that I was so deeply strong for peace in Vietnam. The only person in the leadership of this country who has seen war is Colin Powell. And he's the one person who's trying to keep us from doing something rash. The other guys, they've never seen it. They talk about wars if it was a chessboard. Maybe we'll do this. Maybe we'll do this. They don't know that people are dying. Sometimes I think the best way we could get on the media, if we were allowed to be on the media, would be to take a baby in our arms and say, "Do you want to kill this baby?" I don't think there's one person in the United States
who would say, yes, I want to kill that baby. But if we go to Iraq, we'll be killing thousands of babies. So first of all, I'm against war, period. Okay. Now, the second thing I'd like to say is the way to deal with a fight between individuals, husbands and wives, or nations, is not to give each one of them a club to hit the other. Now, if you have a little boy who gets in a fight with a kid next door, and they're you know, hitting each other or throwing mud at each other, what do? Do you go down and give your kid a bigger club, a bigger baseball bat to hit the other kid? No. You say, hey, wait a minute, boys, what's the problem? Who hit who first, or who insulted your sister, or whatever? So what I'm trying to say is the only way we can become peaceful in this world is to get at the roots of the anger. The roots of the anger against America is that in many parts of the world, for millions of people, we are the terrorists. It used to be that there was respect and even affection for the United States. Let's say in the early 50s, with the Peace Corps and the Marshall Plan, and they believed that we were indeed a compassionate democracy. But now in those same countries, Africa, Asia, Central America, no longer. Now, it is not a nation for whom they feel affection and respect, but fear. And we will never have peace until we are a nation that is loved and respected rather than a nation that is feared. And the third thing I'd like to say, and I'm preaching to the choir here, thank God, it's a very big choir, is this, that this Iraq situation is only a symptom of something that goes much deeper into the soul of America. It's a symptom of our disease by which our leadership, not the people of the country, I know and feel, but our leadership solves problems by power and force. What do they do if a kid has a drug problem? Lock him up, throw him in prison, throw away the key. And usually he's either black or Latino. We know that. That's part of the same thing. What do they do about the so-called drug war? Do they give rehab centers all over the cities of the United States and in the rural districts? No. They bomb poppy fields in Colombia and put peasants into a starvation situation. So you see, it's the same thing. And I believe, and this is my final thought, I believe that really, ultimately, it is the religious people of the United States, the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, the other people of goodwill of other religions who have deep in their heart a love of God and a love of their fellow human beings anywhere in the world. And I think that most Americans, if you would sit down with them, that's the kind of people they are. And to have our nation, a nation that is feared, a nation that solves problems by bombing, is not the kind of people we are. We have to somehow, as religious leaders, so-called, rally the people of the United States to be who they are, loving, compassionate, decent people. And only then, when we root out the roots of the anger against us by outreach and compassion to the world, will we solve what's before us tonight.
Brothers and that was the Right Reverend Paul Moore, the 13th Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of New York. He died on May 1st after suffering from lung and brain cancer. He was 83 years old, born November 15th, 1919, died May 1st, 2003. Thousands came out to his funeral at his church, St. John the Divine, in New York this past Saturday. And by the way, if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back in a minute.
Blue eyes fighting the grey eyes, fighting the tears. Armed to the teeth, through all the words reaching all the ears. I advanced across a poppy field. I saw the gleaming, she raised your shield. Love screamed down with the sun behind its back. Our fathers were all soldiers. Should we be soldiers too? Fighting and falling like soldiers do. Nothing is clear in this tactical, unclear war. Senses. I see no reason to drop my defences. I stand fast, my emotions rally round my shaking heart. Our fathers were all soldiers. Should we be soldiers too? Fighting and falling like soldiers do.
Like Soldiers Do, Billy Bragg, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Last week, we were joined by Victoria Talikorpus. She is with the International Forum on Globalization, based in the Philippines, also with the organization the Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research, which is based in the Philippines. She came to the studio to speak about issues of globalization and war, along with Martin Kaur and John Cavana of the Institute for Policy Studies. Afterwards, they went over to the United Nations to talk about globalization and then gave speeches at night, continuing their series of people's teach-ins around the world around issues of globalization. Victoria Corpus Tolle.
Framework to create rules in or laws in our own countries. And in the Philippines, we now have a law called the Indigenous Peoples' Rights Act, which is patterned to this draft declaration. And now we are using this law to tell the government that even if they have agreed, for instance, to WTO agreements, which will allow our government to bring in corporations to our communities so that they can exploit the resources there, we say that you have the Indigenous Peoples' Rights Act, which is supposed to protect our rights to our ancestral lands and also to protect our rights to self-determination, which means our right to determine how development should take place in our communities and our right to determine how we can govern ourselves and how we can use our customary laws to protect ourselves and to live harmoniously together. So we were able to use these laws to protect our lands and our resources. And now many indigenous peoples in other parts of the world are also trying to get this law to also work in changing their laws in their own countries so that they will have those kinds of possibilities. So the work that's happening globally is brought back to the local, to the national level, and we use it to protect our rights, even in the local communities. And hopefully we will be able to replicate these kinds of actions in different parts of the world. And beyond that, we also thought that we should participate in the UN, for instance, the World Summit on Sustainable Development, because even if these are just processes which are not really coming up with, you know, with treaties or conventions, they can still develop frameworks which can support our struggles as indigenous people. So we did participate in the WSSD, and in this process we brought all the different indigenous peoples in different parts of the world. We came together in a summit which we called the Kimberley Summit, because it was held in Kimberley in South Africa, which is the actually, it's the ancestral domain of the Khoisans. You know, these are the indigenous peoples of South Africa who were there even before the other peoples came in. And in here, we formulated our own indigenous peoples' plan for sustainable development, which is now recognized, at least in the UN. Now the UN is meeting in the Commission on Sustainable Development, and in their report, they recognize that this is the plan that indigenous peoples have come up with through their own processes, and the UN should be able to support this kind of implementation plan. So these are just a few of the things that we have been doing to emphasize that we have the alternatives, that the communities where we are living are already alternatives by themselves. And what is needed is for the international community to reinforce and strengthen the possibilities for these communities to exist, and also the national governments to also recognize that in a country, there are really diverse peoples and diverse systems that should be allowed to flourish and to develop further. And this is one of the principles that was highlighted in our book, The Alternatives to Globalization, the principle of cultural diversity. And it's really one of the key principles that we keep on pushing even in the different arenas, even in the WTO, because we think that in a country, it's not as if you just have one single kind of people or one ethnic group. You really have multi-ethnic or pluri, in Latin America, they call pluri-ethnic societies, which is composed of different peoples, and they have different systems that are coexisting together. And what globalization has done is it wants to destroy these diverse systems and create a system which follows their dominant development model. And if that is what they are wanting to do, then by all means we should resist that and assert our right to be diverse and to be different and to maintain diverse economic and production systems and also diverse cultural systems. And I think by us pushing that, by indigenous peoples bringing this whole principle into all the different negotiating arenas, we are having some results in terms of even changing some of the laws or challenging some of the existing rules that are already there. For instance, in the WTO, the TRIPS agreement, which Martin mentioned earlier, we are challenging the TRIPS agreement by saying that this does not protect the traditional knowledge that we have, the traditional systems that we have to protect our own knowledge or intellectual property, and therefore it should not be used, and it should not be used in our own communities. And now we are in the process of formulating and bringing into the table what are the alternative forms of protecting traditional knowledge that are even contradictory to what the TRIP says. And we would like these kinds of formulations to come into these different agreements, whether these are being developed by the World Trade Organization, the Intellectual Property Rights Organization, or even other bodies like the Convention on Biological Diversity. So these are the efforts that the indigenous peoples have been doing, you know, in a very sustained manner, and it's something that we always wanted to do in a global level, but make sure that it comes back into the local communities and it's used as a tool by the communities to strengthen further their rights for self-determination, and by doing that, we are able to provide also a model of how to strengthen these movements, and also how to replicate these kinds of models in different parts of the world. So I would just like to end by saying that this the indigenous peoples who have been coming together in these different gatherings are now more than ever convinced that we really have something to share to the world. We have something to share in terms of shaping a world that we would like our children to live in the future, and our grandchildren to live in the future. And this, the possibilities for us to be able to defend these communities, the possibilities for us to be able to come into the global arena and talk about these developments, these systems that we have in our communities, should be strengthened and allowed so that the world maybe can learn from what we have to share, what we have had saved through centuries, and hopefully some elements of what we are doing can be emulated or replicated by other communities. And I think the moves now for for localization, the moves for coming up with sustainable consumption and production systems, one of the things that we did, for instance, in Kyoto during the World Water Forum was to bring case studies of traditional water management systems that indigenous peoples are using up till now. And in fact, one case was the case in my town, where we presented how we are managing the water system, whether for irrigation purposes or drinking purposes, which we are still practicing up to now, in spite of the fact that the government wanted this to be changed, you know, because of the World Bank conditionalities through the National Irrigation Administration. They wanted to change this whole system. We persisted that this shouldn't be changed and this should remain as a practice. And so it's still very vibrant. It's still being done. And we presented this in Kyoto during the World Water Forum. And we were surprised that all the other indigenous peoples, whether from Bolivia or from Ecuador, who came, also presented these kinds of practices. And as a result of that, the UNESCO, for instance, is saying that these are the kinds of things that we should, in fact, write about and push for. And we are encouraging now the UN to put this as viable practices and to put this as examples of why the privatization of water resources should not be allowed, especially in communities where these kinds of practices are being done yet. So I think, in spite of the gloom and the pessimism that we can see prevailing because of what is happening now, many of the experiences and the examples that we can see in indigenous peoples' communities, I think, are...
And you've been listening to Victoria Karpus-Tolle. She's with the International Forum on Globalization from the Philippines, recently in New York, giving an address, one of the many teach-ins that the IFG does around the country. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rybel, and Vilkatsouris. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with Rich Kim. Our website, democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The world's holy cow is in crisis, and the crisis is a profound one. Every kind of outrage is being committed in the name of democracy. It's become little more than a hollow word, a pretty shell emptied of all content or meaning. It can be whatever you want it to be. Democracy is a free world's whore, willing to dress up, dress down, willing to satisfy a whole range of kinky tastes, available to be used and abused at will.
Today, The Hour, with Arundhati Roy in our Firehouse studio. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Doctors in Iraq fear that hundreds of Iraqis may be suffering from radiation poisoning following the widespread looting of the country's nuclear facilities. This according to the London Telegraph. Many residents in villages close to the huge Tawatha nuclear facility, about 7 miles south of Baghdad, are showing signs of radiation sickness, including rashes, acute vomiting, and severe nosebleeds. Alarmed by the reports, the International Atomic Energy Agency last week sent a letter to reiterate earlier demands that the U.S. grant the agency access to Iraq's nuclear sites. But so far, there has been no response. In a major overhaul of leadership in Iraq, most of Washington's top civil administrators in Baghdad are being sent home. Retired Lieutenant General Jay Garner is expected to leave within the next 2 weeks. Barbara Bodine, who's been in charge of reconstruction of the Baghdad region, will be leaving within the next day or two. Others expected to leave soon include Margaret Tutwiler, in charge of overall communications, Tim Carney, who'd been overseeing Iraq's Ministry of Industry and Minerals, David Dunford, a senior foreign service specialist on the Middle East, and John Limbert, the ambassador to Mauritania. This all comes as State Department veteran Paul Bremer arrived in Basra today to become the new top administrator in charge of rebuilding Iraq. He's formerly with Kissinger Associates. The BBC reports Iraqis have become increasingly frustrated that their lives remain in chaos more than a month after Saddam Hussein's regime was toppled. Several Baghdad neighborhoods still lack electricity and running water. Rubbish is piled up in the streets, and many shopkeepers are reportedly too afraid of looters to reopen their businesses. There's a lack of security, ministries are not working properly, and salaries are not being paid. We turn now to Sharif Abdel Qaddous, correspondent for Democracy Now! In Baghdad.
The situation in Baghdad over the last few days seems to have grown more and more tense. The looting and violence continues. There are buildings on fire around the city, and at night you can hear the crackle of gunfire intermittently. Carjackings are very common. The day before yesterday, one of my colleagues was in a car about a few hundred meters down the street from the Sheraton Hotel, where we are staying. He watched as five men, two of them armed with pistols, swarmed around the car and directly in front of him. So one man points his gun inside the driver's seat window and fires six shots at the driver. This was at about 2:30 p.m. and happened only a couple of streets down from where a U.S. Army tank and a few soldiers were stationed. So it seems not safe in the city. Also yesterday, the telephone exchange building on Rashid Street was on fire. This was at about 1 in the afternoon. I rushed over there after seeing...
And that was the report of Sharif Abdel Qaddous, Democracy Now! Producer in Baghdad, as you could hear his report cut off in the middle. Well, more news from Iraq. A new report by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization says Iraq's agricultural system is on the brink of collapse, raising fears that many of Iraq's 24 million people will go hungry this summer. According to the London Observer, government warehouses that would have served as the main suppliers of seeds, fertilizers, and pesticide sprays have been looted, particularly in the center and south of the country. The group directing all known U.S. search efforts for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is winding down operations, planning to head home after finding no proof that President Saddam Hussein kept clandestine stocks of outlawed arms. This according to a report in the Washington Post. And this news, U.S. Secretary of State General Colin Powell warned today that the emergence of an Islamist government in Iraq would, quote, not be in the best interest of the Iraqi people or its neighbors. Powell made the comments as he emerged from a meeting with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Powell is on a tour of the region in an effort to revive the Palestinian-Israeli peace process. Ayatollah Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, the most prominent leader amongst Iraq's majority Shia Muslims, has crossed into Iraq for the first time after 23 years of exile. He told an ecstatic rally of over 100,000 people in Basra that Iraq must have a totally independent government. The Bush administration took a step toward developing a new generation of nuclear weapons Friday when the Senate Armed Services Committee approved a bill that would lift a 10-year ban on researching small atomic bombs. The bill also provides $15.5 million in funding for research on a large hydrogen bunker buster bomb called the Robust Nuclear Earth Penetrator, a bomb which would be at least six times more powerful than the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Secretary of State Colin Powell said Israel must ease restrictions and hardships on Palestinians in the occupied territories. The comments were made during a joint news conference with Palestine's new Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen. Powell's in the Middle East to promote support for the U.S.-backed Middle East peace, but Powell left Israel without gaining any firm commitment from Israel to the plan. Meanwhile, the Israeli army reimposed a full closure of the Gaza Strip late yesterday because of security considerations, it said, less than 24 hours after lifting restrictions to coincide with Powell's visit. On Friday, Israeli troops raided the offices of the International Solidarity Movement. Two international activists were arrested and will be deported. A Palestinian was also arrested. Over the weekend, at least one Israeli and three Palestinians were killed in the occupied territories. Foreigners are being forbidden from approaching security walls near Jewish settlements and from entering parts of Rafah, which the Israeli army considers to be a military zone. More than 20 Israeli army jeeps surrounded the ISM offices in the West Bank before soldiers broke into the building, confiscating computers and documents. Two international activists expected to be deported are 28-year-old Christine Rosalski of Chicago and Australian Miranda Sissons, who works for the New York-based Human Rights Watch. 22-year-old Palestinian Fida Gharib was also arrested. The raid came just hours after the Israeli military announced it would begin requiring foreigners entering the Gaza Strip to sign waivers absolving the Israeli army from any responsibility if the army shoots them. Visitors must also declare they are not peace activists and not connected to the international solidarity movement. In recent months, several members of the International Solidarity Movement group have been killed or seriously wounded during Israeli incursions into the occupied territories. In March, an Israeli bulldozer crushed Rachel Corey, the 23-year-old student from Olympia, Washington, when she tried to prevent it from demolishing Palestinian homes. Last month, the Israeli army shot an unarmed British peace activist from the group in the head. 21-year-old Tom Herndl remains in critical condition. 24-year-old Brian Avery was shot in the face. He, too, remains in critical condition. The British government has also demanded an investigation into the shooting death of British cameraman James Miller, who was shot by the Israeli military last week while shooting a documentary for HBO on the effects of violence on Palestinian children. And this news in from Chechnya, at least 30 people have been killed today, dozens more injured after a trailer loaded with explosives rammed into a government building. The BBC reports the attack in the northern town of Znamenskoye is being blamed on Chechen rebels who are fighting for independence from Moscow. International monitors have left Indonesia's western province of Aceh ahead of a possible military attack against rebels. The Indonesian government has demanded the Free Aceh movement abandon their independence campaign, lay down their arms, and start talks on local autonomy. 600 more Indonesian troops are expected to arrive in Aceh shortly to join thousands of soldiers already in the province. The Indonesian military has killed thousands of Acehnese over the last years. Here in this country, Michael Powell, son of General Colin Powell, Michael Powell, chair of the Federal Communications Commission, is expected to propose an increase in the U.S. television cap to 45% when he presents a draft of new media ownership rules to his fellow commissioners on Monday, this according to the Financial Times. The existing cap prevents one company from reaching more than 35% of the U.S. national television audience. Increasing the cap would allow large television networks to buy more local stations. It would also eliminate the need for Viacom, which owns CBS, and Rupert Murdoch's Fox to divest stations because they're currently in breach of the cap. On June 2nd, the FCC's five commissioners will vote on Powell's proposals. And this news from London, Claire Short resigned this morning from Tony Blair's cabinet. The International Development Secretary accused Blair of breaching assurances that he made to her about the need for a legitimate Iraqi government organized under UN mandate. The FBI investigators now suspect the anthrax-filled letters sent to politicians and media figures in 2001 may have been prepared underwater using equipment investigators have discovered in a Maryland pond, this according to the Washington Post. The find represents the first physical evidence to surface in the case, and it strengthens the growing belief that the attacks were carried out by someone with possible links to the U.S. bioweapons establishment. The pond on the outskirts of Washington is 8 miles from Fort Detrick, the headquarters of the Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases. No suspects have been named so far in the investigation, but Attorney General John Ashcroft has named Dr. Stephen Hatfill as a, quote, person of interest in the inquiry. The Washington Post noted Hatfill is a former Fort Detrick employee on bioterrorism. He also had a postgraduate diploma in diving and underwater medicine from a South African Naval Training Institute. He trained in South Africa under apartheid. Hatfill has vigorously denied any involvement and has accused the FBI of ruining his life by leaking its suspicions to the press.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand?
Sarah Thompson, sent in this song, Is It for Freedom? Each time we play it, people call in from around the country to try to find out where it's from. We know nothing more about it except that it was recorded for us. Sarah Thompson, wherever you are, let us know how people can get a copy of Is It for Freedom? This is Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers across the country. And Amy, the Bush administration, apparently a month into the occupation, has conducted its first purge of its own civilian administrators. But of course, no one in our media here in the United States is calling it a purge as Baghdad continues and Iraq continues to fall into chaos and anarchy seems to prevail. And yet the Germans and the French kept warning the Bush administration this was precisely what would happen if they unleashed this war against Iraq, and now it's turning out to be so. And at the same time, we've got Michael Powell over here in the United States. Friday, we discussed how Michael Powell had yet to tell his own commissioners on the FCC what his plans were for deregulation and concentration of the media. He apparently must have heard us in Washington on Friday, because over the weekend he decided he's going to release his plans to his commissioners today. But of course, there's more than just a 35% cap involved. You're talking about the total consolidation, unprecedented consolidation of the U.S. media that's about to occur. And interestingly, I had mentioned previously our organization, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, had called for a halt to these decisions. We were joined recently by the National Association of Black Journalists, the California Chicano News Media Association, the National Association of Lesbian and Gay Journalists. But most of the other journalism organizations in America are being silent over the massive transformation of the American media that is about to occur on June 2nd.
And one of the benefits of having independent media is being able to play programs like we're able to bring you today. And that is an hour with Arundhati Roy. She was born in 1959 in Shillong, India, studied architecture in New Delhi, where she now lives and worked as a film designer, actor, and screenplay writer. Her first novel was The God of Small Things. For it, she won the 1997 Booker Prize. It was the 50th anniversary of Indian independence, and the first time an Indian citizen had won this British prize. The book has sold 6 million copies, has been translated into over 20 languages around the world, and I'm sure it's more than that at this point. She's also written 3 nonfiction books, The Cost of Living, Power Politics, and now War Talk, which collects essays analyzing issues of war and peace, democracy and dissent, racism and empire. And she has now become the recipient of the Lannan Foundation Prize for Cultural Freedom. Tomorrow night, she will be giving a major address at Riverside Church, and then she'll have a discussion with the great historian Howard Zinn. Well, today we're talking about and with the acclaimed writer Arundhati Roy. Since September 11th, she's emerged as one of the most eloquent critics of the Bush administration's so-called war on terror. Paul Hawken recently wrote in Wired magazine, if Roy continues to upset the globalization apple cart like a Tom Paine pamphleteer, she will either be greatly honored or thrown in jail. In fact, she was jailed in March 2002 when India's Supreme Court found Arundhati Roy in contempt of the court after months of attempting to silence her criticism of the government. Today, she joins us for the hour in our Firehouse studio. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it is a great pleasure to be able to see you face to face and talk to you in person. We've spoken to you on the phone many times, and I very much look forward to your address tomorrow night. Well, your book has come out now in a new edition, War Talk. And in it, it includes one of the speeches that we have run a lot here, and that is your speech come September that you gave in Santa Fe. Juan mentioned the issue of media centralization in this country. In India, you see the United States through the lens of, what have you, you've said Fox is what you watch?
Yeah, Fox and CNN, I think, are the two channels that you get there.
So what do you think? What do you think of America through that lens?
Well, you know, it's true that, you know, last year before I came, I was coerced to come to America because I did think that there was no need for me to come here and, you know, be insulted and called names and so on, because you think of it as a homogeneous place in some way. And I was so delighted to find the opposite. You know, I was so delighted to find that we who are protesting against these things outside have some of our staunchest allies in America. And I must say that, you know, it put me in the extraordinary position of defending, you know, American citizens against an assault which is absolutely racist sometimes outside, because of these media channels and because of the policies of the U.S. government. People in America are just seen as a homogeneous bunch of rabid nationalist bullies. And that's such a sad thing, because I think if we are going to fight to reclaim democracy, that fight has to begin here. And all of us have to acknowledge that it is the people of America who have access to the Imperial Palace, you know. And so it was wonderful to come, but at the same time, this consolidation of the American media, I mean, I think one of the good things that happened after September 11th was that this myth of free speech and the free market crumbled along with the Twin Towers, you know. Outside America, the American free press has become the butt of some pretty dark humor. And nobody, you know, now it's contextualized. You know, when you watch CNN and Fox News, anyway, not everybody, but a lot of people just watch it as the boardroom bulletin of the White House, you know, and know it for what it is.
Well, in your latest book, War Talk, you talk about empire in a much broader way than perhaps we're accustomed to discussing here in the United States, because we're always centering in on the U.S. empire and the U.S.'s role in world domination. But you talk about empire and all the allies of empire, really, in all the different countries around the world, including your own. I'm wondering if you could expound on that a little bit.
Well, you know, there are two ways that empire spreads its tentacles. One is with the cruise missile and the daisy cutter and so on. And the other is with the IMF checkbook. So, you know, the argument that is being made across the world is that the people of Argentina and the people of Iraq have been decimated by the same process, but by different weapons. In one case, the cruise missile. In the other case, the checkbook. And what happens is that, just like the colonial enterprise, which needed the collusion of native elites. You know, it wasn't as though Britain had huge armies stationed in India. It had the Indian elite colluding with it. In the same way now, this project of corporate globalization has the collusion of local elites in third world countries, you know. And so what happens is that you have a process in which the white man doesn't even have to come to the hot countries and get malaria and diarrhea and die an early death, you know, because it is being managed on their behalf by governments like, say, the government in India or the government in South Africa, who are willingly genuflecting to that process. And a situation in which, very interestingly, say you look at a country like South Africa, you know, 1994, apartheid officially ended. By 1996, the ANC, who had fought so hard, and people who had fought so hard for that freedom, look what's happened to them. Out of a population of 44 million, 10 million have had their electricity and water cut off. And you have the traditional power, the white power in say South Africa, more secure and happier than it has ever been, because it's apartheid with a clean conscience now, and it's called democracy.
How do you decide when to write fiction and when to write nonfiction?
That's a very, very troubling question, you know, because, well, I don't decide. It decides, it somehow decided somewhere else in the ether. But the fact is that, you know, for me, fiction is my love. You know, fiction is what makes me happy. The other writing that I do, each time I write, I swear I'll never do it again because it sort of wrenched out of me, and it ends up, you know, I end up paying a price for it, which I'm not sure that I want to pay, and that's not just in, you know, that's just not in prison sentences or criticism or insults, which I have my share of, but even the other, you know, it keeps pushing you into this very public place where, you know, there are times when you don't want to be, you know, you want to be tentative and you want to be uncertain and you don't want to sort of bang your fist on the table. And yet I know that there are times in the world when you can't look at it as what you want to do or where you want to be. You have to, you know, you have to intervene. It's like I never ever decide to write something in terms of my essays, you know, like if someone asks me, some newspaper asks me, will you write this, or someone asks me, I always say no. It's just when something happens and I read about what's happening and then I know that there's something that I, you know, something that hasn't been said, which I want to say, and then it sets up this hammering in my head and I can't keep quiet and I have to do it, and I do it, and I most of the time regret it immediately.
We have to break four stations to identify themselves, but we will be back with Arundhati Roy, here live in our Firehouse studios, just blocks from Ground Zero, from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. Stay with us. Shad Khan, Gypsy in Red, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Arundhati Roy. Arundhati Roy's books, The God of Small Things, a novel. Her essays collected as The Cost of Living, one book, Power Politics, and her latest is called War Talk, published by Southend Press, an independent press in this country. Arundhati, can you talk about where you grew up, where you were born, where you grew up, and on this day after Mother's Day, your mother, Mary Roy?
Well, I was born in a town called Shillong, that is in the northeast of India. You know, India's like more complicated than the whole of Europe. So, you know, my mother was from South India, is from South India in a state called Kerala. My father was from Bengal. I was born in Shillong, which at the time was in a state called Assam, but now it isn't. And my parents were divorced when I was, you know, about one or something, and I came back with my mother to Kerala, where I grew up in a village called Aimanam, which is the village in which The God of Small Things is set. It's a very, she comes from a community of Syrian Christians who believe they were converted at the time when St. Thomas traveled east after the crucifixion of Christ. So, but the first real evidence of that is around the 8th century. Anyway, it's a very small parochial community, and my mother was sort of shunned for being this woman who dared to marry a Hindu outside her community and then got divorced and came back to the village with her children and so on. So I suppose, you know, now that that's behind me, I have to look at it as fortunate, because I grew up on the edges of an extremely feudal, suffocating society where, you know, which was not prepared to assure me the assurances that it would hold out to other sort of, you know, children who belonged to that community. One was outside it because you were not of it. And because I grew up in Kerala, which has traditionally been a communist state, it was very interesting because you had Christianity, Hinduism, Muslims, Marxists, all sort of rubbing each other down, and you lived outside the framework. I lived outside the framework of all this, growing up in a rural area, but at the same time having the, you know, being educated in the ways that other people would not have been in a rural area. So I keep saying that as a writer, it was a lucky place to be at the top of the bottom of the heap, somehow without, you know, the perspective, the sort of tunnel vision of the completely oppressed, without the paranoia of the completely, you know, of the oppressors. Somehow you grew up in the cracks between this very complex society.
And why was it that Kerala, being, as you mentioned, such a feudal and rural place, could then develop to have a communist administration so early on? What were the conditions and dynamics that gave rise to that? What kind of impact did that have on your consciousness?
Well, don't make the mistake of assuming that the communists are not feudal. You know, it was a sort of they are more progressive than others. But you know, what they did was to harness that feudalism, to kind of not challenge it in some way. So the irony, of course, is that the communists are all upper caste people and, you know, very intellectual and so on. But the situation was, I mean, that's what, of course, the God of Small Things is all about, the contradictions of that, you know, where you have Kerala is the only place, say, in India, where they claim 100% literacy, and yet the kind of oppression that you see there, or the kind of attitudes towards women that you see there, is so suffocating. You know, my mother is you know, I didn't talk about her. She's the most she's a remarkable woman, also someone who I often think kind of escaped from the sets of a Fellini film, but that's separate. And she she really, you know, it was a combination of her being in this place where, you know, she was shunned and, you know, ridiculed for who she was. And so I never grew up being told that I should play by the rules, you know, which was very lucky for me. But I find myself in this really strange position, because so many years of my life I spent fighting to escape the suffocation of tradition as an Indian woman, and I got there only to be up against the bestiality of the modern world, which I don't want either. You know, so you're somehow in this little narrow alley between these two monolithic, monstrous things, and you know, sometimes you just don't know where to go with it. Every single decision that you make is a decision, and a political one, you know, for that reason.
Your mother ran a school and also stood up for women's rights in India.
Yeah, my mother runs a school. I studied there. She started it when she left my father, and she started it with 7 children, 2 of whom were her own. It used to be what I call the sliding folding school, because it used to be in the premises of the Rotary Club. In the evenings, the men used to meet and drink and smoke cigarettes and throw the butts and their dirty glasses on the floor. In the morning, we would come and clean it all up and, you know, open up the furniture, and it used to be the school, and then in the evening they'd come and dirty it again. So now, of course, it's a beautiful school. It's on, you know, just on the outskirts of this little town called Kottayam. And yeah, she still runs it. It's a fabulous place. She became very well known, my mother, because, you know, she filed a case, a public litigation case in the Supreme Court of India, challenging a law which said that Syrian Christian women could inherit 1/4 of their father's property, or 5,000 rupees, which is about, which is less than $100, whichever is less. So she challenged that and said it was unconstitutional, and the law was changed with retrospective effect, giving women equal rights. So that was a very, very big thing then. Not that it has made such a huge difference, because that was a law in case a man didn't leave a will, in case a father didn't leave a will. So now, of course, they are taking will-making classes in how to disinherit their daughters.
And now, like it or not, Arundhati Roy, you have ended up in court yourself on several occasions. One had to do with your own book, as people in Men in Kerala called The God of Small Things Obscene, or at least some sections of it. And then in your own activism around the issue of dams in India. Can you talk about both?
God of Small Things was, I was accused of corrupting public morality, which the case is still in court, actually. And I keep saying there's a technical legal issue here, because at least it should have been further corrupting public morality, since I can't believe public morality was pure until I came along. But yeah, you know, it's in India, the legal system is like this lumbering thing. It's part, you know, like 75% of it is about harassment. It's not about conviction. It's not about what will happen at the end. It's about court appearances and paying lawyers and disrupting your life and so on. You know, it's used for that reason. For me to go from Delhi to Kerala to appear, it's like almost like going from Delhi to London. It's so far away. And I'll go there and the judge will arrive and he says, everybody's ready to argue the case. And he says, every time this case comes before me, I get chest pains and I don't want to decide it. You know, because he knows that everybody's waiting for him to say something. He doesn't want to. So then it's dismissed, and it's been going on for years. The other one is much more serious, was much more serious and is much more serious, because, you know, there are two ways of looking at it. One is just personally the court harassing a writer, a famous writer or whatever. But that's not as important as if I can explain an issue of democracy. Because, you see, people now have begun to think of democracy as elections. You know, that's it. That's the only genuflection you have to make in the direction of democracy. But in actual fact, it is a lateral system of checks and balances with various institutions, you know, checking each other and balancing each other. Now, in India, the Supreme Court is perhaps the most powerful institution in our so-called democracy. And now it takes decisions which it's a micromanagement of Indian society. It decides whether slums should be cleared, whether dams should be built, whether industry should be privatized, whether diesel should be the public fuel or it should be, you know, compressed natural gas, whether industry should be moved out of a city or not, whether history textbook should contain such and such a chapter or not, whether this mosque should be built or not. Every single decision is taken today by the Supreme Court of India. Now there's a law called contempt of court, which says that you cannot criticize the Supreme Court. You can criticize a judgment, But you can't say, put a series of judgments together and say, look, there's a very distinct politics emerging here. Or why, you know, you can't question it except in their terms, let's say. So that makes it an institution which is completely undemocratic. And I was, you know, hauled up on contempt of court. And I was saying, you can't have this law. You know, you can't have this law and then call yourself a democracy. It's a judicial dictatorship. And that's what it is. People are terrified, terrified of the Supreme Court.
And why do you think that that has evolved in that way, that this judicial dictatorship? What in the political development of Indian society has allowed the court to exercise such power?
Well, I think, I mean, the philosophical answer to that is that we are still a feudal society who look to authority somehow, you know. But really what has happened is that, you know, power looks for ways in which to subvert democracy at all times. And so you have a situation where you have a very corrupt political elite. You have a media that is increasingly becoming a corporate media. And so you have this court. It's like you have a system. You have this contempt of court now, which is a law, which means that the court works like a manhole, like a floor trap. It attracts all the power because it's not accountable and it's able to exercise unaccountable power. Today, if I had documentary evidence of a corrupt judge, say I had evidence of a judge having taken a bribe for making a particular judgment, I can't put that evidence before the court because it's contempt of court. Truth is not a defense in contempt of court. So you can imagine the extent of power that is being exercised. It's completely unaccountable. And now, having put me in jail on this, what has happened is that the message has gone out to the Indian media that don't mess with us. If we can do this to her, you think of what we can do to a journalist in a little town who has no money, who can't hire a lawyer, who doesn't have the protection of, you know, being a public figure. They can just be thrown in jail. They lose their jobs. They lose everything. So they just allow the court this wide berth, and it keeps going. You know, sometimes it makes judgments which are good, but most of the time its judgments at the moment are retrogressive, you know. And of course, those judgments suit the middle class. It suits the Indian elite. So the court is a holy cow. So they say, oh, but how can she, you know, like, one, there should be respect for something, you know, that hierarchical way of thinking.
We're talking to Arundhati Roy, author of The God of Small Things. Her latest book is War Talk. We'll be back with her in a minute. Sheila Chandra, Roots and Wings, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is the acclaimed writer Arundhati Roy, author of The God of Small Things, The Cost of Living, Power Politics, and War Talk. War Talk is her latest book, collection of essays. You were just talking about going to court. Maybe if you could briefly tell us about the issue of the dams in India, and then we could talk about, for those who watch us on TV in our breaks, we were just showing Gujarat. You can talk about what's happening there.
Well, the issue of big dams in India is really somehow a microcosm. It's not a microcosm, it's such a big issue, but it tells the story of modern India and the model of development that that country has chosen to follow. There is a river called the Narmada in central India, which, on which this Narmada Valley Development Project has proposed to build 3,200 dams on a single river. Now, for years, there's been a very spectacular resistance movement against the building of these dams by people who stand to be displaced by them. And in early 1999, in an interim judgment, the Supreme Court, decided to allow this very controversial dam to be built, and I wrote an essay called "The Greater Common Good," where when I traveled in the Narmada Valley and found things that shocked me, among which were not the facts that exist, but the facts that don't exist. And one of them was that there were no figures for how many people have been displaced by big dams in India, because big dams are like secular temples, you know. And I calculated that figure to be 33 million people, which, of course, at the time I wrote the essay was mocked, and people said, how can that be, and so on. Subsequently, the World Commission on Dams did an India country study where they place it at almost 56 million people, all of whom are obviously the poorest, the untouchables, the indigenous peoples. And so the whole thing, again, is a critique of how you centralize natural resources, how you snatch them from the poor and redistribute them to the rich. And that process, of course, was carried out pretty successfully by the corrupt Indian state, as in all third world countries, but now it's become even worse because that process is being privatized. And it's like everybody thought, oh, this doesn't work for us, so maybe privatization will make it all efficient and just. And in fact, it's like giving a malaria patient, medicine for jaundice. It's become so very much worse, so very frightening. Thousands of people are now being pushed off their lands, not just by dams, but by the corporatization of agriculture, the privatization of water, the whole process of the WTO. And now you have reports from all over of, Indian farmers committing suicide by the hundreds because they are not able to cope. And there's a drought looming. So, obviously these are issues that are complex, and I can't really, I can't convey anything but the urgency on a radio program. But I have written about it in some depth.
You talk, again, in the speech you did at Puerto Alegre, which is reproduced in your book, War Talks, about not being forced to choose between the mad mullahs and the malevolent Mickey Mouses as a choice that was being confronted many of the people in the Third World. But interestingly, I've mentioned this on the program several times, the Pakistani Marxist Tariq Ali, in his book, Clash of Fundamentalisms, lays out the theory that really the resurgence of fundamentalism in the Middle East, especially, was a direct product of British and American imperialism in their attempts to prevent the Indian modernists Gandhi and others from moving forward to prevent the Egyptian progressives of the 1950s and 60s. They supported the rise of fundamentalism. And in essence, there is some tie between the continuing process of imperialism, both British and U.S., and the rise of fundamentalism in the Middle East and in India and Pakistan. I'm wondering your thoughts about that.
I completely agree, except that he should bring India into it too. If you look at things now, there has never been a closer association between the U.S. government and any Indian government before. And today we have what can only be described as a very quick march towards fascism, towards religious fascism. And the American government and the Indian government and the Israeli government are more or less aligned on this, you know. And if you see how there's a connection, not just between, corporate globalization is the project of imperialism, if you like, you know, and you see how closely those two things are allied, and you see how what is happening in India, the massacre, the state-supervised massacre of Muslim people on the streets of Gujarat, you know, is not being condemned, is being allowed to, you know, there it's almost been approved of now in the way things are going there. And of course, there's a link between, it suits this project really well, you know, fundamentalism, religious fundamentalism of any kind.
Gujarat, it is between who?
Between Hindus and Muslims.
And but where does the government stand in this?
Oh, the government is, the Indian government today is the BJP, which has this, it's called the Sangh Parivar, which in Hindi means the family, you know, of basically Hindu right-wing political parties, cultural guilds, goon squads. And between themselves, they divide the labor, you know. But last year, this time, in Gujarat, the BJP government, headed by a person called Narendra Modi, sponsored, supervised, oversaw the slaughter of 2,000 Muslims on the streets of Gujarat. 150,000 were driven from their homes. Women were gang-raped and burnt alive. And after that, he won the elections, you know. It's a very big crisis for our notion of democracy. While that was happening, while the slaughter was happening on the streets of Gujarat, I was being put into prison for contempt of court by the Supreme Court. Not a single murderer, not a single person there was proceeded against. But they all stood for elections, and they won. You know, so how do you call that democracy? What is the difference between democracy and majoritarianism, and where does it shade into fascism, and where does nationalism fit in all this, you know?
You talk about the major forces that people are on the ground are up against when you talk about the dams, when you talk about globalization. If we can end also on the issue of war, invasion, and now occupation. What about the force of the people? I think of the women, your friends, who are willing to drown, to stand in the areas that they are supposed to be displaced from, to say, the waters can rise, we won't leave.
Well, you know, I think we need to, I'm in a state right now where I feel that we need to re-examine our ideas of resistance, you know. I think we need to think about this very carefully, because we saw perhaps the most spectacular display of public morality ever on the 15th of February, when millions of people across five continents marched against the war. It was discarded with disdain. Those marches were important. Those marches were important for us to rally our forces, to understand our strengths. But those marches didn't affect the other side. You know, so we need to now understand that the time has come for civil disobedience to become real It's no longer symbolic. The marches can only be the symbol of something else that's real that we are doing, you know? Our meetings in Porto Alegre, our marches and our demonstrations are for us, but they are not weapons we are using against them, you know? So we need to now change our way of thinking to be effective. You know, it's enough of being right. Now we need to win. And now we need to win not necessarily by confronting empire, but by taking it apart part by part and disabling those parts. I think we need to make a list of every single company that has benefited from a reconstruction contract in Iraq, and we need to go after them and we need to shut them down. You know, that's what we need to do. We can't think that, you know, it's beyond the stage of resistance songs and marches. Those are for us. You know, those are important for us. But we need to pick these people off one by one, because we can't confront empire. We can't confront it all together. We can't nobody can deal with America's war machine. But we need to reverse those sanctions. You know, we need to make people sanctions. We need to look to our strengths and do it right now. You know, we need to take out our spanners and undo the nuts and bolts of empire.
And it could also be, though, that the reaching in deeper into the populations of these various countries, so that those sectors of the population, whether it's people who work in these industries or people who provide the shipping for the tankers, in other words, that at a certain point a movement will reach those sectors of the population that have a decisive impact if they're organized sufficiently to push back.
Absolutely. You need to get to the people who say, we will not move this missile from the warehouse to the dock, you know?
Or the soldiers. Or the soldiers themselves.
Yeah.
And you see that happening. Is there somewhere that is giving you hope?
Well, I think I'm a pre-programmed optimist, you know, so I'm the wrong person to ask, but I think, you know, I think it doesn't, the point is that for people like us, we have to do this anyway, you know, we have to do what we do anyway, whether there's hope or despair is a way of seeing, you know, but even if there wasn't hope, I would still be doing what I do, you know, because that's what I do, that's who I am, that's how I am. So, you know, we can't be only fighting because there's hope. If there's only despair, the reasons to fight are even greater.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. When you speak at Riverside Church, what will the name of your speech be? Have you decided yet?
Well, it's called Imperial Instant Mix Imperial Democracy. Buy one, get one free.
Well, I very much look forward to seeing it and hearing you speak and speak then afterwards to Howard Zinn. And in New York, there still is overflow seating, though the tickets sold out within hours of them going out. I think about a month ago, thousands of people have already gotten tickets. It's up at Riverside Church on the Upper West Side of Manhattan if people want to go tomorrow night, Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. Arundhati Roy, I want to thank you very much for being with us. It's been a privilege.
Thank you.
Arundhati Roy, her latest book is War Talk. It is published by South End Press, and that does it for the program. If you'd like to get a video copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. You can see video and hear audio streams of our show at democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now, produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Rival, Vocal Tsouris, Mike DeFilippo, Rich Kim, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.
If she could fly away, so far away.